You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Thursday, 31 October. We've got local PPI at 11:30 this morning. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, he's from Perpetua Investment Managers. We had the MTBPS yesterday. I've got to say, a little downbeat. I'd hope for perhaps some better, but it was, well, it is what it is. We'll get his take on that. Sana Kudir, she of Absa, the latest merchant spending analytics report. What is that revealing around shopping habits? Richard Hill from Stonegate Fleming, private markets, what are they and why are we seeing a significant rise in their prices? This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, News 24, Lewis leaps 11% to a 52-week high after flagging profit growth of between 45 and 55%. Business Day, Treasury rejects 4.7% wage hike proposal for public servants. Finance Minister says proposal was from facilitation process and not a full offer. Morning markets, US was red, S&P down a third of a percent, NASDAQ off 0.8%. The East is mixed. Sydney down a tenth of a percent. Tokyo down 0.4%. Hong Kong is up half a percent and Tencent 0.75% higher. Commodities mostly green. Gold 2,797. Briefly touched 2,800 overnight. Brent 72.90. Platinum 1,109. And palladium down is 1,146. Rand 17.67. Bitcoin 72,300. Top 40 opening call minus 390 points down. That's about half a percent in the red.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Trading now with Lonwabo Mkabele, Perpetua Investment Managers. Lonwabo, the midterm budget policy statement yesterday from the minister, it was maybe a little more downbeat than I think many, certainly myself included, had expected. I suppose that is the stark reality of our economy. We might have electricity and a functioning government of national unity, but on the economic front, there's still a lot to do.
Hi, good morning, Simon. I also thought, quite similar in the sense that, the challenges still remain. And I'd probably say the way out of the challenges is growth. And I guess in this budget, it's important to put in context that this budget is really about the $400 billion that South Africa's expenses exceed, its revenue. So that on its own is, so it's a big number and it's a reality check. As a percentage of GDP, it's 5%, so it's not extremely high. But the budget really is about trying to understand how this is going to evolve. And I guess on the positives, they're expecting a primary surplus. So primary surplus is really revenue minus expenses before interest. For the first time in 15 years. So I thought that's a good thing, and they're probably guiding towards that continuing, in order to keep the balance in check and debt in check. I guess, on the positives again, we've seen some of the impacts that Operation Vulindlela has had, reduction in power cuts, and you're seeing a rebound in Transnet's volumes, the e-visa skills program that'll also have an impact. But I think, I guess the disappointing part that you refer to is that really that the growth outlook remains below 2%, and in fact they cut it further since February. So one would have thought that improving electricity would see some kind of impact, but it actually just shows how difficult conditions remain. And then they also did actually then also cut how much they're expecting from tax revenues by some 22 billion rand, and cut future years' expectation as a consequence. So if you think about that $400 billion deficit, it's kind of moving in the wrong direction in revenue. And then I say expenses as well. So, they had to pay 5 billion rand to Sunrail for the Gauteng improvement project. It did come from the provincial government, so the Gauteng provincial government, but that's kind of moving your money from one pocket to the other, you know, and then, you know, they're guiding to another 5 billion further to come from Gauteng. They mentioned 2 billion rand that's being spent on the DRC by the SANDF.
Yeah.
And expecting another 11 billion to encourage early retirement by senior government employees. So I'd say expense is also moving kind of in the wrong direction.
So
I was just to say that, hence that kind of disappointment that you mentioned in your introduction.
Yeah, and you and I chatted a month or so back, I think just after perhaps the September rate cut, talking about the MPC, talking around the high rates and hindrance to growth. There was a line in that the minister made, which maybe I'm reading too much into it, almost implying that we maybe should have this debate around lower inflation target, i.e. maybe a 3% rather than a 3-6, which is effectively 4.5. Nice idea, but that perhaps might mean higher rates for longer. And growth in a high rate environment like this is not easy.
Yeah, I think that's 100%. Also made the same observation, Simon. It does increasingly seem like the monetary policy direction will be towards lowering that inflation target. So initially 3-6 and kind of more like a 4.5 target. That 4.5 target is likely to move most probably closer towards 3%. So I agree, it does imply that rates, you know, there will be rate cuts, but just not as much as everyone thinks, just so that we can anchor the inflation expectations lower. Long term, I understand completely what monetary policy is trying to do. I think the environment of, I guess, this fiscal difficulty that we just mentioned through this budget plus the monetary policy does actually imply that it's a very tight, does create tight conditions for the economy.
Yeah, no, I take your point. And the key point, as you say there, maybe rates are coming down slower than we would all hope. We'll leave that there. Lenoir Nkabele from Perpetua Investment Managers. Appreciate the early morning time. And that is our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. What would you score the budget? There's all the scores on the homepage of MoneyWeb. Go have a look at those. But would you give it full marks? Was it a fail? My sense was it was a decent pass. It is a tough, tough budget out there. We got power, but there's lots we don't have. Not enough revenue. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. The Standard Flexible Income Fund delivers capital preservation and consistent top quartile inflation beating returns. Let your money keep working with Standard Asset Management even after you retire.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Thasana Kodua, Head Consumer Goods and Services Sector Coverage at Absa CIB. Thasana, appreciate the time today. Your latest Absa Merchant Spend Analytics report, this for August 2024, is out, showing some growth, but truthfully, modest growth.
Absolutely, Simon. And we've also seen now the September numbers coming out, and even more muted growth. So not a great story at all.
I was going to ask about September because I thought maybe we would see some pickup coming through on the back of the two-pot, but maybe not.
No. In fact, we are, for the month of September, seeing negative growth in consumer spending. And you know, the spending is based on our card analytics. Mm-hmm. And when looking at the two-pot and trying to understand why this is the case, we come to a few ideas as to how this is playing out. The first thing is, you know, it does take some time for the money to flow into this consumer's pocket from the claim date. So we think there is a delay. We also think that consumers have earmarked that money for very specific purposes and not just spending it hazardly. It might be for debt reduction, which would be positive from an economic perspective, but it also might be for certain items they deem necessary or they want to spend on, such as their December holidays or education for their children, paying their school fees. So those are the things we're thinking that is going to pull the money, but definitely it's not in the system yet. In September, we've seen nothing.
You mentioned in some of the data, in pre-pandemic, food and clothing was, some 69% of overall market share. This has come down quite markedly since then. Is that trend continuing?
Yeah, so we saw food in 2019 having a 56% share of the consumer's spending wallet. That has come down consistently every year, and it's now kind of stabilized in 2024 at around 50%. And we see clothing going from 13% in 2019 to around 9% of the consumer wallet. So between the food and clothing categories is the 10% move in what consumers are spending their money towards, if you look at the overall wallet.
The food one is worrying, or is it perhaps more about consumer habits?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think there's a lot of stress in the consumer system and in the households. You know, so we do think that the non-discretionary spending is definitely being curbed by the consumer to deal for other, or the discretionary spending is being curbed for dealing with other non-discretionary items as it becomes a priority for them. We spoke about education being maybe one of those. But the other trend we are noticing is there's a category that's called business and professional service. So we track these categories of spending based on the label applied at the back end. And in that business and professional services category is our fintech solution companies. So if you think about these small card acquiring machines, you know, that's say, for instance, Yoko, if a consumer snaps with that or taps there, it will come through on our end as a business and professional service. So what can that maybe tell us? It tells us that there's definitely a move towards spending at smaller retail options, both online and in store. And this could be various categories. It could be food, it could be clothing, but it does beg the question, are smaller retailers starting to steal some market share from big retailers? And it's an interesting thing to think about. And it links to what you've just mentioned is consumer behavior and habits, you know, being healthy, using more local produce, direct from farming, those kind of trends we are seeing emerging in the consumer spend.
And also maybe just the good old fashioned, if you're living in a more rural or township, you might have gone to the local big city, but now maybe you shop local because that trip to the city is no longer cheap. Petrol is expensive.
Absolutely. And remember, we do not see the cash spend in the numbers that I'm speaking about. Yeah. So a lot of that, we do believe there's a huge uptick in the township economy spending, but that's predominantly still cash, although there's a lot of incentives to also digitize spending there. But we think that economy is actually doing quite well and pumping. And the mid to upper tier spending is where the real pain is starting to be seen. You know, it's your guys that has homes and cars and a lot of debt that is really struggling at the moment.
Yeah, and that actually ties in when I chat with some of the REIT CEOs, those who've got more exposure, sort of shopping malls in rural and townships doing better. You've mentioned online. Is online, I mean, obviously in the pandemic, we went crazy. It was the only way we could shop when we could. How's online sales doing?
It's still doing double-digit growth. Obviously, it's not as big as it used to be when it kicked off in, like you say, 2020. But it's consistently growing. We see a consumer that's using it in an omni-channel fashion. So they'll stand in a Shaw store and Google quickly where they can find that product maybe cheaper. You know, really the dynamic has changed completely because of the consumers adapting to online and omni-channel. So definitely it is still growing and I don't think it's going to go away.
We'll leave it there. That's Sonia Kudia, Head Consumer Goods and Services Sector, ABSA CIB. Appreciate the time. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Richard Hill. He's Stonehage Fleming Private Markets Partner. Richard, appreciate the time. Private market assets, which broadly I imagine are sort of unlisted, a sector that's expected to double by 2029, and that doubling takes it to $12 trillion. This is a massive market and growing.
Indeed. Thanks very much, Simon. Thanks for having me. Yeah, indeed. And really, we're just seeing a continuation of the trend which has started, you know, many years ago. I mean, certainly since probably 2000 when we've been looking at the statistics, and private markets has grown. Obviously, overall financial assets has grown, but private markets have certainly grown within that as a subsector. And we certainly see that continuing to be the case.
We're seeing shrinking exchanges here in Johannesburg, but we're seeing the same in Europe and the UK. We're even seeing it in sort of New York and the like. Is that one of the drivers? Just a sense that, you know, you might have an asset and then it delists in the private space. The companies are more likely to stay private, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the only driver. I mean, it's certainly one of them. I mean, the real key driver is the fact that the opportunity to invest in private markets has just got so much bigger. The amount of, I guess, the asset managers that have been created within the private market space have proliferated over the last years in all segments as well. So we're not just talking about, you know, the traditional private equity funds, but you could talk about venture, you can talk about private credit now, you can talk about direct investing as well. And really, it's just exploded. And I think that's really the key driver. You've got much more ability to get access to private markets than you might have done even 5 to 10 years ago. And so that availability of private market capital out there means there's an alternative source of finance for companies. And I think clearly with those increased sources of finance for companies, they're taking those wider opportunities. And whereas they might have ordinarily seen listing as an inevitable outcome, now it's no longer, you know, has the inevitability that it once did.
I take the point, absolutely. The days of listing sort of being the only way to raise capital are long gone. You mentioned sort of VC money there, credit, private equity. Is part of this also just the diversification? I mean, you know, our global indices, certainly in the US, very tech heavy. I imagine you can find a lot in the space, and not even necessarily from a return, but just a lack of correlation with traditional listed equity.
I think that's right. One of the key areas where family offices are looking for that diversification, they're looking to even out the price volatility you often see in public markets, potentially looking to hedge against inflation. But you're right. I mean, there's plenty of sectors and also asset classes that can act as a really good diversifier against their public market exposures. So I think that's probably one of the key areas as to why family offices are certainly looking at this space.
Are there potentially better returns? I mean, as soon as I mention venture capital, a bunch of listeners' ears pick up and they think, oh, yes, you know, the old cliche, imagine if you had gotten to, I don't know, Meta when it was still being run out of a dorm room.
Yeah.
I mean, is there logic to potentially better return, or is that not necessarily?
I think there's a good body of evidence to show that in private markets delivers higher returns than public markets or has done certainly over the last 20 years or so. But I think it's also right to say that dispersion of results are probably much greater in private markets than they are in public markets. So to your point about, you know, missing out on a potential VC opportunity, I mean, you've got to think that that may be one of, you know, hundreds in that space that happens to be the winner. And it's often the high profile ones which take the public gaze. But you forget that, you know, in the interim of the business, when the business was founded, it was probably competing against many, many other startups and happened to result well. So I think, you know, certainly there's limited evidence to suggest that just by investing in early, you get better returns. I mean, for example, I don't think the average venture capital fund return is any better than the average later stage growth equity fund, for example. So I think it's all about making sure that you're working with the right people, working with the right managers, working, you know, with experts in the field. And that obviously increases your chance of identifying the winners and not getting, you know, sucked into the losers.
Yeah, and I like your point. And if we go to Facebook, there were undoubtedly dozens, hundreds, thousands of others at that point, but one rose and that's one we point to. Is there also an aspect here of, you know, I'm thinking, you know, if you take a good-sized position in a good-sized company, but, you know, a large sort of US or European listed, you're going to get invited to the AGM and not much more. Is there also a desire from some of these family offices to, I mean, maybe you're a non-executive and independent director, but to have more influence on strategy and business?
We're definitely seeing that, and particularly from those investors who are successful exited entrepreneurs, definitely want to have more influence in terms of how they invest their capital. And in some cases, you know, want to be able to demonstrate that influence, you know, on the companies that they invest into as well. And you're right, you know, you investing in a public company, you've got limited access. I think actually in investing in many private equity funds, you'll ultimately have limited access to the deal doers, the investors, and, you know, particularly the underlying investee companies. So that's why I think it's certainly part of the reason why we're seeing investors wanting to invest direct, because, you know, they then do have the ability to see the underlying investment companies and have some sort of relationship, perhaps add some value, perhaps, you know, add the network that they've created in their successful business lives. So it's much more possible at that direct level. It's certainly not less likely to be the case at the fund level, and certainly not in public markets.
Yeah, and I like your point. In many cases, it might be successful entrepreneurs. They sold a business and they want to sort of keep fresh and keep on managing businesses, even if only at non-exec. We'll leave it there. Richard Hill, Stonehag Fleming, private markets partner. Appreciate the time.
That's it for today. Yesterday, we were chatting with Tertia Jacobs from Investec ahead of the midterm budget policy statement. We asked you if you were expecting any surprises. Almost half said you want to watch expenditure. A third said not really much to report. The rest said maybe on collections. And certainly expenditure and collections were disappointing, I suppose, is the polite way. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by StanLib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Garth McKenzie, lessons for a younger self.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.